What follows is the fabled lost pilot to
Pool Party Radio.
Originally planned to air May 31st, 2000, it was lost on the test audience who hated it and was eventually lost under a pile of unaired Wonderland and Wasteland episodes. Unfortunately, someone found it, and now you're going to have to watch it. Tune in next week for a much better episode. For now, though, courage.
Bro, what's up?
Dude, just watching the dating game.
Right on. Hey, dude, guess what tonight?
What?
Pool party, my house, 8 o'clock.
Yeah!
You don't even know, dude. There's gonna be food and girls and more food and Mike Tirudo's coming. Hold on, dude, hold on.
Pool party, baby. It was a cool party, cool.
Welcome to Pool Party Radio. This is the first inaugural edition of our new podcast. I am Parker Bowman, and with me is my co-host, Jason Frisbee.
Hi there.
And we decided to come together on this, make a podcast. I host, co-host another podcast called Junk Food Dinner, and we recently celebrated our one-year anniversary. And I thought, well, hey, this podcast that we've been doing, we actually have listeners and people who give us feedback, and people who download the show, and maybe I should start another podcast where that won't be happening. Starting over from scratch is always fun.
Would you say that starting from scratch is much like starting a new character on World of Warcraft? See what I did there?
That's a good segue. That is a good segue.
It is an excellent segue.
I would say it's exactly like that. I a while back, a few years ago, I got obsessed with World of Warcraft, and then I gave it up when I met my wife, so that I could spend time with her and not be leveling up 24 hours a day. And somehow, just a few weeks ago, she just decided out of nowhere, she was like cooking some bacon or something, and said, hey, let's get World of Warcraft. And so since then, I guess that was about in January. So if that goes to show you anything of how my concept of time gets altered when I'm playing World of Warcraft, I've been very obsessed with this game in the months that have followed my wife out of nowhere suggesting we get it. And it's very depressing to be like sucked back into this thing wholeheartedly. I mean, at least on the bright side, I have like three friends that play, which is way more than I had before. So I guess technically me playing World of Warcraft is a lot more social than I was previously, not just in my previous stint playing World of Warcraft, but in my previous stint of being alive and being a total hermit and not talking to anybody. Have you ever been addicted to any video games, Mr. Frisbee?
Not in the sense of World of Warcraft. I know there's been some games I've been addicted to, but it hasn't been anything that's, I guess, socially cognizant. Like, people know about World of Warcraft because it even reached levels of South Park stardom. I mean, you remember that where... Did you ever see that episode?
Oh, yeah. I love that episode.
And I think they've even packaged that season, since that was the most popular episode from that season. It was End of World of Warcraft. They packaged the box set with a copy of World of Warcraft. That's how integral the tie-in was.
I think that's this? Yeah, I think that's how I got started playing it to begin with, is I bought that. I bought the DVD box set of that season, and then it was like free 10-day trial. And I was like, well, I got nothing to lose except for my whole life.
Yeah, and except your whole life, exactly. And that's been my only exposure to it. As far as a game that even comes close to that, that I had an addiction to, like a real addiction to, God, I started playing Ultima Online back in like 98, wasn't it? 98, 99?
Yeah, I think I was still in like high school or something when that was out.
Right, right. And I was playing it with a friend of mine back in the outskirts of Dayton, Ohio. And that was the closest I came, but here's how my addiction ran. Like, day one, I upload the game. And when you started Ultima Online, you start a new character, each new character would have a piece of this green jade armor. You either had like a sleeve or a helmet or a torso or pants or something. And I'm walking around as a goddamn fisherman. Like, it's Ultima Online. I could do anything I want. I could talk to dragons. I'm like, nah, I'm going to fish.
Yeah, that's understandable. That's exactly what I did. I had a friend named Tom who had that game. And I made a character named Squee, and his whole story, because this is back when role-playing games actually required you to role-play, not like Warcraft, which I'm sure is just making my argument for these things being nerdy all the more. I'm sure we've lost all of our listeners who have had sex before. I had this guy named Squee, and literally all I would do for hours and hours is chop wood and sell that wood for bronze coins or something. That game was just absurd.
The commerce. I mean, yeah. It's so feasible there, because it's like, you can, you know?
Yeah, it's Ron Paul's favorite video game.
It is, yeah. And if Rand Paul got involved, there would be no education whatsoever. They're just like, we'll cut that part out for some reason. There, now you're good. Make sure you have a surfing class. But yeah, I played it. I started up that new character, and I had like a green sleeve. And I'm like, all right, time to go fish. And you're walking around the main forum area trying to go out to go fish, because that's what you look like you're going to do as a fisherman. And all these people would like run up to me, little chat bubble appears. Hey, do you have any green armor? I'll buy it for like, you know, 1,000 bronze pieces, something like that. I mean, they're blatantly trying to rip you off, but they're all trying to collect the green suit of armor to go adventuring. And I'm like, yeah, sure, whatever, I'll sell it. And then I was like, no, I don't want to be a fisherman. I actually do want to try to talk to dragons. So day two, I get out, I have like a green helmet, and I'm like, oh, cool. So I get it now. You get a piece of this suit of armor. I walk out, hey, I'll give you that this much for whatever green armor you have. I'm like, no, I want to actually play the game and try to collect it myself. I'm like, no one's going to be able to deal with this, man. Like, I'm not getting this. Like, I'm being harassed like I'm at a flea market or something playing this game. And then I went out, and I think I tried to, like, tame a badger or a lion or something, because I thought that would be awesome. And I'm walking through the graveyard, and then some kid playing as a wizard threw a buzzsaw at me, and I threw the game out. And that was my addiction. That's how long the addiction lasted. It was 2 days.
Yeah, that's all that game was just getting killed by other kids who had been playing longer and had cool wizard staffs.
Yeah, yeah. They had their robes and wizard hats set to go. So that was terrible. But no, I mean, I understand the difference with World of Warcraft. I mean, what do you think it is that is so enticing? Is it just a leveling up, or is it just multiple aspects of this game, like the visuals and the group efforts that you have to go through to complete a task?
Well, it's certainly not the groups. Every group I've ever been in just consists of, like, one guy talking about how great Linkin Park is, and then, like, some other kids complaining about, like, who is more of a fag. I mean, all the groups have been just horrible. And then, like, you hear the N-word all the time. It's just terrible, terrible people who play this game. I'm not sure. Like, the only thing I could really equate playing World of Warcraft to is, like, gambling in Vegas. Like, everybody always says that, like, gambling in Vegas is fun, but it's, like, the least fun thing you can do. Like, you're just sitting down and like pushing flashy buttons, and it's like sort of vaguely social in that somebody is drinking and smoking next to you, and every once in a while you might look at them.
Right.
And I mean, there's no skill needed in either one of these. In fact, there might be more skill required to play slots than play Warcraft. But I mean, at the end of the day, like, there's the possibility that maybe you'll either, you know, win $200 in Las Vegas, or you'll win like an enchanted rune staff in Warcraft. And I think that's okay. I think that's what everybody wants to get to, is maybe one day getting an enchanted rune staff. That way you can wave it above people's heads, figuratively and literally, I guess.
Gotcha. So it's, I mean, is there really skill involved? Like, I mean, you have to be able to control a character, because my knee-jerk reaction is just to think like, okay, so you have grand results for minimal effort. And that's like the payoff. But I know that's not it, because you actually have to control these characters, right?
Yeah, sort of. I mean, I've like played, like I've been in like these huge like boss battles and stuff where like I've like been eating, you know, soup at the time. And like I like take my dog out sometimes in the middle of these battles and just stuff like this. Like I change the channels to find good stuff to watch in the background. So, I mean, it's, you don't even really have to pay attention too much of the time while you're playing. It's, I think maybe that's part of the appeal.
Okay, because I was under the impression that it was more nerve-wracking. You have all these fail videos online of people raging when, like, somehow their girlfriend, wife, or significant other has deleted their Warcraft account, and it just results with them, like, punching their fists, doing a Falcon Punch through the computer. Falcon Punch! And then, you know, ruining their chances of ever playing the game again. Because I guess it's just the fact that everything's built up in the game. Like, you get these items, you level up, and then that's all gone in an instant.
Yeah, yeah. That would probably be incredibly enraging, I would suppose.
You think that would enrage you? Like, what if you came home and your wife had deleted your account? What do you think of what your reaction would be?
Well, I think that she's more addicted to me than me, and to me. She's very addicted, so I don't think that would happen. But actually, our computer that we play World of Warcraft on, which is not my computer, it's her computer, died. So we've been, like, sitting around, like, all sweaty and itchy, like, not being able to play this game for, like, the last week or so. It's really, I mean, we like, hit each other a lot now, and we hit the dog a lot since this happened.
Do you expect to gain experience points when you do this? So you can level up?
It's an experience for the dog, that's for sure. He doesn't like it. But yeah, it's been just a terrible time without the game.
It sounds like the withdrawal scenes from Trainspotting.
It's exactly like that. I have been crawling into a lot of toilets lately.
There you go. Yeah. And reappearing on the other end in the World of Warcraft map. Happy April Fool's Day, by the way.
You make it sound like it's Christmas or my birthday or something.
It kind of is, because it's so nationally recognized now. The reason I'm bringing this up is because I was looking online, and according to Kotaku.com, they had a list of just April Fool's Day best, worst, and worst, worst. And one of the best things that they thought existed for an April Fool's Day prank for today, but Blizzard had Krabby, the World of Warcraft helper, and all it is this blue crab that has the eyes and eyebrows of the Microsoft Word paperclip. And it appears in the bottom right of your screen, takes up a great deal of space. Like, I haven't played this game, but I could see how obnoxious it would be if you were to play the game. And it has all these screenshots of what it looks like with Krabby helping you along your quests. And it's like, looks like you're about to fight a boss. Maybe I can help you with that. And it gives you little blue text hyperlinks to click on. Do you think that would be helpful at all?
That would actually probably be fun. And it would probably work out for my wife. Like, my wife doesn't really play video games. So, like, every 10 minutes, she's like, husband, what is an orc? What is that? And then I read The Lord of the Rings to her.
From a podium in your apartment. Or do you live in a house now?
Yeah, I've got a house.
Holy cow, look at you.
Yeah, no, it's terrible. It's the worst house ever.
I doubt that.
It's made out of cement, so it's, like, always either way too hot or way too cold. I don't know the science behind it, but it's terrible.
I obviously do not know the science behind it either.
I don't know how science works. Let's move on, because we don't know science. Speaking of not knowing science, the Japanese are in a whole lot of trouble with their nuclear reactors. I don't
know.
The Simpsons is going to be banned in a lot of different countries because of their jokes about nuclear mishaps. And apparently people think it's too soon, despite the fact that most of these jokes have been on The Simpsons for 20 years or whatever. A few episodes have been banned in Germany, Japan, and Australia, and a few other we'll see countries. You know, this is mind-boggling, because it's not like they're making fun of it now, or making fun of Japan. Like, I mean, these are episodes that have been around forever, and I don't understand, like, if you, like, forget that you know, that nuclear meltdowns are going to happen. Like, if The Simpsons don't remind you of nuclear meltdowns, then you're not going to die from nuclear radiation, I guess, is the reasoning behind this. I don't understand how this helps anybody.
I know. And like you mentioned, we'll see countries that would ban these episodes. I got to remind you, though, that we've encountered this, too. After the Twin Towers were hit by two commercial jet airliners and fell in 2001. There was a ban on radio broadcast media, and I forget if it was Clear Channel specifically. I really forget which organization listed this, but there was a ban on some songs that had anti-American sentiment. So, I mean, if, like, banning episodes of The Simpsons is one thing, and who knows how many other shows are being banned with, you know, nuclear implications, like, you know, there might be The Hills Have Eyes. That might be banned in some countries because of the nuclear association, the mutants. But, I mean, you couldn't listen to Rage Against the Machine on the radio. Not that you necessarily want to, because it would probably be half-edited anyway. But, you know, what's the point of that, either? Like, it's a show that every nation is capable of this censoring in lieu of a tragedy in which the art that they're censoring has nothing directly responsible for the tragedy or fault or mishap that occurred, right? I mean, it's not like The Simpsons caused this. If anything, they were just trying to make light of a situation that was obvious. I mean, nuclear power plants might be reported as a cheap source of fuel, but their security staff is incredibly, they can be negligent. And like, hell, Diablo Canyon, out near California, those water pumps, their safety valves had not been updated and were in not working condition for the past year and a half. They were only checked upon in response to the Japan mishap. And they're like, whoops, good thing that tsunami didn't carry over to the West Coast here, because we would be boned.
That would actually be great, because I really enjoy the Fallout video games. So if nuclear catastrophe happened here, I would just be stoked to fight super mutants and stuff.
That would
like the way that most like kids get like excited that maybe one day there'll be a zombie apocalypse. I'm really excited to one day just be Mad Max.
Yeah, exactly.
Have to fight inside the Thunderdome.
right.
But yeah, head writer of The Simpsons, Al Jean, said that he's cool with these people banning a few episodes. He said, you know, we've got 500 episodes. It's all right if they ban a dozen of them, which is silly to me. That's sort of like being like, oh, you know, Hitler only wants to kill a dozen Jews. Let's just go ahead and let him, you know. I mean, what can it hurt?
Right. God, I really don't know if I want to go along with the Hitler analogy, because I want to say it's either all or nothing. And in that case, it just sounds awful. It's either all Jews or nothing. Obviously, I don't want to say that. I'm going to try a different analogy, but it would be like having a museum full of artwork and censoring a few of them because they were like nouveau art or like the Wild Beasts or something. Any of those art movements. And you had to censor a few of them just because they were new and nobody was a real fan of them. So yeah, you just put cheese over them during a showing or during a party. That's not right. I mean, if you stand behind your art or the art that you want to display, then yeah, I agree. It should be all or nothing. You can't just hide a few pieces like you're ashamed of them. It's not like you're kids or anything. You can't just put them in the attic when company comes over.
Another reference to the Holocaust, hiding in the attic.
And she's... No! Okay, you got me. No, obviously, it's not what I meant, but you have a way of turning stuff on its head.
I can turn a phrase like an Oscar Wilde. That's what you're saying? Thank you.
Best
compliment that you could give me.
Yeah.
That I gave myself. But yeah, another thing that's real weird about this is that this is Japan, you know, and like, you know, Japan being sort of, I guess, shielding themselves from the jokes on The Simpsons about nuclear mishaps. But their whole culture seems to be built around nuclear mishaps. I mean, you know, they've obviously been hit with nuclear weapons. And then every single Japanese movie for like years and years and years was just about, well, hey, out of the radiation, we got Godzilla and we got Mothra and stuff like this. Like, I mean, they're not strangers to the idea of radiation and turning that into entertainment about said fears.
And it's really interesting the way they do now as opposed to previously. Like, Godzilla went from, like you said, you know, this afterthought to the nuclear bombs dropping on Nagasaki and Hiroshima. But the Godzilla character became like this child-friendly hero, you know, is like, well, maybe I'm thinking of Gamera. Yeah, I'm thinking of Gamera. Never mind. Gamera was a giant flying turtle. Godzilla was just this. Godzilla was basically your angry drunk father who would get up if too much noise was being made by Mothra or something. And then he's like, what's going on? smack, going back to the ocean, wake me when Cheers is on. And didn't really have an association with kids. Cut that part. That didn't make any sense. What I was going to say is that Japan actually has a different way of approaching this for explaining it to the kids. Like, the news reports I haven't really seen, but one thing I did see was how to discuss this possibility of nuclear fallout, nuclear meltdown, to children. And it's a animated slideshow. You can look this up. It's like Japan nuclear meltdown 2011 kids. You can do like a YouTube search with those keywords. And it's this little slideshow with the narrator over it. And I kid you not, it just talks about this little character. They don't call him like Fallouty or Nukely or any cute name like that. But he's just a little character. And the narrator describes that sometimes he's just got to poop. And that's what nuclear meltdown is. And they're like, he compares it to other places like Love Canal. It's like, and that character, you know, he had to poop really bad. Then they go to Chernobyl, which is the most horrific nuclear meltdown from a power plant ever, like out in Russia. And the Chernobyl one, they describe as having diarrhea all over the place. Those are the translated words.
Yeah, so these are obviously a people that don't take nuclear fallout seriously at all.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It's poop. It's just poop.
It's just poop, kids. And when you get a poop on you, I mean, what is it? Just yuck. It's just yuck. It's not going to melt your skin off or anything.
Make you sterile.
Right. It's the kind of poop that makes you lose your hair. You ever had that?
I got that all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. Spicy tuna rolls will do that to me. And welcome back to Pool Party Radio. This is Jason. I'm talking with Parker again here. Back from the break, really quick, I wanted to bring up the fascination that I have with almost a lost form now, a sketch comedy. The reason I call it lost form is if you ever watch SNL lately, it's obviously dead or dying. So anyway, in lieu of all this, in lieu of just sort of not seeing a whole lot of sketch comedy out there, to my knowledge, I did a return to watching The State, Kids in the Hall, Upright Citizens Brigade, all of which I found on Netflix Instant Queue. And it's a pretty stunning comparison. Like, you can see how much of a form of comedy, how much this form of comedy was prominent back in the early 90s, late 80s. It's also just really great work being done, really great comedy that still holds up just about 20 years later for most of that stuff. Of course, Upright Citizens Brigade, that was late 90s, but still like 10 years later, you know, they bring in the Wu-Tang Clan as a cameo appearance and it's still relevant. Oh, so I've been enjoying these different approaches to sketch comedy. Like, Kids in the Hall is the Troop of Five. The State has somewhere around 11 people. And UCB goes down to, again, to bare minimum of 4. But they all do it well by sort of interconnecting sketches or just segmenting them out well and pairing them well. And it's kind of a wonder why it's still not... It's kind of a wonder why it didn't stay popular. Like, I'm wondering where the fallout was from these really great shows to now when all I can think of is, like, SNL. I mean, do you think it's a resurgence in stand-up comedy or maybe viral videos that have taken over?
It's probably sort of like what happened with stand-up in the 80s, where all of a sudden everybody became a stand-up and everybody was wearing rainbow suspenders. I think that maybe that happened in the 90s, where like everybody in college was part of a like an improv troupe, you know, or like a sketch troupe. And
oh, that's true. Yeah.
And then like it just kind of became like played out and dumb. Like, even now, like, Human Giant, who's was, like, a new and very brilliant sketch troupe, like, they didn't even call their stuff sketches. Like, if you talk to them in interviews, I never talked to them, I guess, but in interviews, they'd always be like, oh, yeah, you know, we do short films and stuff like that. Like, I think sketch just became sort of, like, a bad word.
Oh, like, oh, gotcha. Like a cliche. Yeah, now I think of it, Whitest Kids You Know is out there, and I don't know if they would associate themselves as doing sketches or not. Like, I never heard the Human Giant interview where they did the Short Film Association, but I can definitely understand that. I mean, not to call out any of those members at all, but they did do short films. Aziz Ansari and... Who's the other guy? There's two of them.
Well, there's three or four. There's Rob Hubel, Aziz, and Paul Scheer. And then Jason Wolliner, but he didn't, like, act or anything. He's their director.
Is Paul Scheer on The League now?
Yeah, yeah. He's very funny.
He is very funny.
He also has the worst role in perhaps cinema history as, like, a cameraman in Piranha 3D, where he's the only person who doesn't get a death scene in the entire movie. There's hundreds of deaths in that movie, and he doesn't get a death scene. It's pretty
depressing. By piranhas in 3D, right? I have not seen that movie yet, but now it might be worth seeing just to clarify that statement, because I didn't even know he was in it, to be honest.
Yeah, he's just kind of like not there at the end. You don't know what happened to him. I think that movie stinks, but Kevin Moss of Junk Food Dinner, he likes that movie a great deal.
But really quick, like Aziz Ansari and Rob Hubel, the first time I encountered those guys at all was on Channel 102, the sister internet broadcast to the West Coast, Channel 101. Channel 102 is out in New York. And Aziz and Rob did this short film, as you did on Channel 101 or 102, the under 5-minute films that made those showings so popular. And theirs was called Shutterbugs.
It was hysterical. I love Shutterbugs.
And I see what you mean now. And I guess it was like the improv troupe especially. There's got to be the connotation of saying sketch and then thinking improv troupe goes hand in hand. Like improv, I guess, has that taboo to it. You know, I still like it. I think it's enjoyable, but I see what you mean now.
Yeah. And, well, improv's problem is that when it's bad, it's just terrible. You just want to just commit seppuku in the audience.
Right, right. I mean, you have to... It's the same thing with stand-up. Like, as you know, I did stand-up for about a year, like just trying to do shows and trying to get on stage. And it is nerve-wracking because you're going to be bad that first year unless you're like a natural talent like Eddie Murphy or something. And I would like to imagine even Eddie Murphy had a bad first year, but who knows. But same thing goes.
And the same thing goes for podcasting. You have a bad first 5 episodes.
That will stay archived forever in the annals of internet history.
But yeah, so you think that Mr. Show and The State and all those guys, you think they hold up?
The funny thing is that even though I own Mr. Show, like all 3 seasons of those, I bought them as they came out. Like I haven't rewatched that recently, which is weird because I think Bob Odenkirk is one of the funniest people alive. Part of me doesn't think that one holds up as well. Something about it doesn't quite work. What I was more impressed with is like I had not seen The State in forever, and I remember watching that as a kid, just as much as watching Kids in the Hall like after school. And what it came down to, the reason I was watching both of those so much wasn't purely because they were just available. My brother and I were discussing this question from this website, who I'd want to give credit to, and I'll do so on the blog. Basically, they give you a choice between 2 items. In this case, it was 2 shows, 2 sketch shows, The State and Kids in the Hall. They came out relatively, they crossed over in their air times. Like, Kids in the Hall was on from 89 to 93, and The State was on from about 91 to 93, somewhere around there. And the question goes like this, say you go back in time to that era, like those couple years, and only one show can be made. Which one is it, Kids in the Hall or The State? Because then you have to think about which one has the longer lasting impact, which one impacted more comedy troupes and televised shows like UCB, like Whitest Kids You Know, like Mr. Show. which one had more of an impact?
Well, I think that would be the state. I mean, everything, you know, everything that's happened in comedy pretty much, like right now, everything that's going on right now, more or less, can be traced to the state in some way. Without the state, you know, obviously we wouldn't have the state itself. We wouldn't have, you know, Reno 911.
Michael of Issues, Stella.
Yeah, Wet Hot American Summer, The Ten, all this great stuff. Even some of the more mainstream stuff that Tom Lennon and Ben Garant do. Like, just all this kind of stuff. But then again, you know, and then if, you know, we didn't have Kids in the Hall, then we would have to miss out on, what, like, news radio.
And see, yeah, I was just thinking
Postal.
That.
Like, the U-Bowl movie Postal.
My gut reaction to that question when my brother posted it, like, I sucked in air through my teeth really quickly. It was like, I'm going to have to say Kids in the Hall. Like, I could not do without Kids in the Hall.
And, yeah, yeah.
And your point is completely valid, because there is so much stuff that I enjoy now, like Wet Hot, Stella, and Michael. Not to mention just what Michael Showalter and Michael and Black do on their own time, and David Wayne with Super Jail, like, in Wayne-y days. But for some reason, and it's not even a guilty pleasure thing, I think it's just because Kids in the Hall acts as such a tome for other sketch comedy and comedians. While it's never directly referenced, like, there's never going to be a Crushing Your Head Guy movie or a Chicken movie, and, you know, God forbid that ever happens. I just think that all those guys during those 5 years, during those five seasons, were so, so brilliant. Like, watching the Kids in the Hall episodes, I was never disappointed. And there are points during the state where they're trying to work in, like, every one of those members to do something. And it's also got the weight of having been on MTV, trying to include all that hip music and just appear hip, which has its own merits too, because, you know, without that, who knows, maybe Mr. Show would never have been broadcast as, like, this edgy hip show, you know, with, like, ex-comedians, alternative comedians on it. So it's a hard one, yeah. But for me, it still remains Kids in the Hall. They're almost like the, not like the Beowulf of sketch comedy, but it's pretty close.
Yeah, I think the Kids in the Hall are 1 billion, like, if you were just to have the DVDs of Kids in the Hall in the state, the Kids in the Hall is worth $1 billion more dollars than the state would be. I think that show's way funnier than the state. Both are, like, both have sort of hit and miss things. I could do without Mr. Heavyfoot on Kids in the Hall. But, yeah. I mean, Kids in the Hall is just tremendous. Everything that Bruce does on that show is, like, the cream of the crop comedy. It's like if God was a comedian and he came all over everybody, that would be... that's the laughs that you get from Bruce McCullough. And Scott Thompson, who's a genius. I mean, those guys are great.
Oh, God, yeah. Yeah. And to connect the Bruce McCullough thing, like, I agree. Everything that guy does, along with everybody else, is genius. But his is a spectacular, unique style of genius in that he did so many of those disjointed, unconnected character short films, like My Pen and My Car. Do you remember the My Car thing where he's like, don't you ever say a word about
yeah.
My Car.
Oh, I love that. I absolutely love it.
Yeah, like, love this song. It's so true. There's so many good lines from just that thing. And it wasn't... The structure was so out of balance with anything else done before that.
Like, watching The State, you could sort of equate it, like you said, like, their hipness. Like, The State is to comedy what's sort of like... Sonic Youth would be to rock and roll music. Like, it's kind of real noisy and weird, but inside there's probably, like, some music in there that's of a certain quality. But Bruce, right. He's like jazz. Like, he's just beautiful. You know, you can just walk down the street humming. You know, you don't have to get all the tunes right, but it's, you know, it's gonna be beautiful no matter what. And that's Bruce.
Which is funny, because one of my favorite sketches is that dual monologue. It's a conversation between the angsty teenager character played by Bruce, and his teacher, played by Dave Foley. And Dave Foley's trying to convince him very happily that rock and roll is dead and has been dead for a while. And that he better make way for freeform jazz.
Jazz schmazz.
Yeah. But that's I like that analogy with the Bruce McCullough short films particularly. And I think Dave did a good job of these too. Like, they're recorded short films. You know, Mark had his characters and Kevin had a few interesting story-driven or meta clips, but Bruce and Dave especially, I think those are the closest to early short films, at least that I can see, on a popularized scale. I don't remember too many of them on SNL before that. SNL was supposed to be live, so Kids in the Hall had the this advantage to be able to show recorded short films, which kind of leads into what Aziz and Human Giant are doing according to that interview.
Yeah, yeah.
And maybe then, even what Whitest Kids You Know are doing. So yeah. I think that's...
And Funny or Die. Like, that's what they do, too.
Right, right. So that wasn't anything subconscious at all. Just from this discussion, I think it makes it still a valid response to see that Kids in the Hall, you know, is one of those shows that you couldn't do without. Obviously, like, you know, Live in the World with both of them, for that for which I'm grateful...
Yeah, otherwise there'd just be suicides everywhere.
Right, right. Yeah.
Speaking of suicide, I wanted to talk about this Huffington Post list of musical suicides.
Right, right.
Some fellow who nobody would know his name anyway, but he's a CEO of some entertainment corporation. He made this list of the top 10 post-Nirvana bands. And his list is completely laughable, and I just wanted to make fun of it for a little bit, because you can tell this guy's a CEO, as he has no concept of what music is at all. His criteria for the list is, you know, people who have made memorable music that sold a lot of records. But his list includes
right.
the Arcade Fire, which Arcade Fire is pretty much just music for people who think that... Wes Anderson movies are the best possible movies. I don't know if they have any redeeming value other than that.
That's his number one leadoff on this list. And it's like saying, you know, that Michael Jordan was the best player of all time because he's on his shoe. They just won a Grammy, guy. It's because they're, I mean, you know, if we took them out of sight, they would probably be out of mind as well. With this list, I mean, if this gives you any inclination of how to list what you're in for when you see the start of it, that's pretty much what you can expect from there on out.
Yeah, yeah. The next band is Coldplay, which I guess we do need Coldplay in our life, because movie trailers would have no music if not for them. But I mean, I don't. Does anybody listen to their music when it's not in movie trailer form?
No, I mean, if you're being sappy and all you have is a broadcast radio, like if you're listening to this podcast, then chances are you will also listen to some sort of streaming music that is catered to your taste. Your taste will probably not include Coldplay if you're listening to this radio show. That's not an elitist thing either. It's just saying, like, you'd be listening to FM broadcasts. Like, oh, all right, Coldplay's on now. Thank goodness I didn't specify what I wanted to hear.
Yeah, we're not on the FM wavelength yet, like Coldplay.
Not yet.
Soon.
Not yet. Coldplay's on, then who else?
Dave Matthews Band is on here. He even goes on to say, they rock, exclamation point, which is insane to say. I think the Dave Matthews Band is... the soundtrack to 85% of all American date rapes. I think that's what he has going for him. You know, when I went to the university, I think that all I heard was Dave Matthews, like, the entire time I was there. In terms of partying. Like, whenever I would go to a party, it would just be Dave Matthews Band, and then whenever I would, like, be on campus, it would be the college radio station, which was full of Arcade Fire. So it was
at the time, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I was getting it on both ends.
That's very funny. And to be honest, like, in no way would I agree that they rock. exclamation point. But this was a huge indulgence of mine, especially when I was younger. Like, I always recognized a Dave Matthews Band song because I had gotten this 3-disc changer stereo system, which I just thought was the coolest thing in the world, and I was just getting interested in music, and the first bands I liked was Dave Matthews Band. So I had all of their 3 albums at that time in each one of the disc changers. But I would always like have that on as I was going to bed because it would help me fall asleep. So in no way would I say that they rock. I would just say like they make me sleepy, which is also fine because you need some music to do that. But I'm not sure why they would be associated with a post-Nirvana list. Like, I wasn't even sure the criteria that he was going for in this. Was it clear? Like, was he saying, like, these are bands that start from humble beginnings, rose to mainstream popularity, and then the lead singer killed himself? Because that's not what any of these bands did.
Yeah, which is a shame in Dave Matthews' case.
No. The guy doesn't need to kill him. Like, nobody needs to kill themselves, especially not Dave. Jeez.
All right. Well, we'll
see. I just want to hear you say potato, potato to that. Like,
we'll see if singing the same tune when we get down to Linkin Park, who's on this list as well.
Okay. Yeah. Point taken.
The next band, Death Cab for Cutie. I absolutely hate this band. They, the lead singer sounds like an effeminate baby. And I mean baby in the truest sense of the word. Like, he sounds like a toddler when he sings. And I absolutely hate it.
Well, I was at that, when you were at university, I was at that university station. And I did play Death Cab for Cutie and the Postal Service, who Ben Gitterd, lead singer, both of those. However, I think your description is pretty accurate. Like, if you really boil it down to the precipitate, you could probably find elements of baby and the femininity at the core root of that beautiful, beautiful voice. That beautiful man voice that he has. That's so uncanny, like a baby girl.
Up next, he's got Green Day. And while I wouldn't disagree with this, he goes on to say, Green Day's Broadway show cements their reputation as one of the best bands anywhere. And I think that's the most inaccurate thing to say about anything at any time. I don't think that anybody's Broadway show is going to cement their act as one of the best bands. Yeah. Next, we've got Linkin Park, the aforementioned Linkin Park. I don't know much about their music, but I do know that the lead singer was in a Saw movie and was in both of the Crank movies. And that's all right with me. I really like those Crank movies. So I'll give Linkin Park a pass based solely on the fact that dude was in Crank.
I thought you were going to play the suicide card again. Just from what you said earlier about Dave Matthews. You're like, oh, wait till we get to Linkin Park. Like, okay. And now that we're here, you're like, pass.
I like him. What can I say?
You're like, those films. But once again, it's just like, you know, they've had very much mainstream success. And they're very savvy about the music industry as it stands today. Like, does it make them the best bands in this post-Nirvana world? Probably not. Like, I'm sure there's skill and talent and craftsmanship that go into it, but maybe there's other bands that have a bit more success in those areas. They're just not recognizing.
Yeah, and maybe those bands don't look as cool on a shoe like Linkin Park does.
Right, right, yeah.
Yeah.
How can I put Linkin Park, yeah, on a billboard instead?
Next, we've got Muse, and I generally enjoy Muse, but this guy goes on to say, it's no surprise that Stephenie Meyer listened to Muse while writing Twilight, and that makes me not feel good about liking Muse anymore.
Exactly. I think that's the most damning thing you can say about any band. You know, if I wouldn't say, just to go back to your Hitler analogy from earlier, like, if somebody said that Hitler was listening to Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue while writing Mein Kampf, I'd probably not listen to Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue anymore. If you follow my not-so-subtle drift about Stephanie Meyer and the Twilight books.
Yeah, up next, dude's got Pearl Jam, which there's nothing post-Nirvana about Pearl Jam. They haven't written a good song since Nirvana was a band. I don't understand how these guys got on this list.
Yeah, they were They're very much important in a contemporary Nirvana world, but not a post-Nirvana world.
And then we've got, to finish out the list, Radiohead and the White Stripes, two bands that I cannot feel more indifferent towards. These two bands are perhaps the iced of the music world. Iced being, of course, the most the movie I'm most indifferent to. Okay. It's a very obscure junk food dinner reference I'm making for for Mark,
right,
and Kevin when they listen to this.
And I don't know what to say. I saw White Stripes live once, and I enjoyed them. I did like what they did as far as bringing back just an original two-piece set and showing that it can be done. But other than that, I mean, I don't know. I think the White Stripes would probably be the most legitimate post on that list, just because at least there is a lot of influence that arrives from that band. I mean, without them, you wouldn't have, like, Black Keys or anything.
That is true.
And even a lot of local acts, at least back in my hometown of Dayton, there was this band called Mountain Screamer that just consisted of a guy on guitar and a guy on drums, and they managed to make it a very high-energy, enjoyable show each time, and music's always a lot of fun.
The story changes. The band from Dayton did the same thing for a while, although they were slightly different type of music.
So, yeah, I think, to me, that was one of the few that rang really true. Like, he was actually pulling something out, because, hell, the White Stripes don't exist anymore. I mean, as far as when the article was actually published, too.
Yeah.
They called it quits. Or maybe they called it quits after that article. Like, we don't want to be associated with this anymore.
We don't want to be associated with Twilight anymore. Damn it. Huffington Post.
Right. But yeah. All in all, it's a very odd list in just how obvious it is, and how out of touch it is, especially in his responses. The quips you quoted there are just a few of the examples that this guy uses to generally describe these bands in the most vague terms possible without giving you a hint of what they sound like.
Yeah, also I feel like this guy maybe just went to like iTunes and then whatever was like the featured bands, he just picked those to be on this list. Yeah. Welcome back to Pool Party Radio. That's the end of the show. We are going to take like a week-long break, as podcasts do. In the meantime, though, we have a website, poolpartyradio.blogspot.com, and you can email us at poolpartyradio@gmail.com, and we would like to remind you that, like with all podcasts, like we said earlier, the first 5 episodes suck, so bear with us until we get good. stay tuned to us, and also listen to Junk Food Dinner, my other podcast. So, until next week, this is Parker Bowman.
And this is Jason Frisbee.
And I don't know what to say. Ending a show is hard. I don't know how Kevin does it. I don't know. Well, yeah, we'll see you next week. Fuck it. See ya. Bye.
Bye.